For some reason, it was easier for me to accept the fact that I graduated high school 3 decades ago than it was that one of the films that first spoke to me, John Hughes's The Breakfast Club, was celebrating its 30th anniversary. The Breakfast Club is a portrait of 1980s American high school life. When Saturday detention started, they were simply the jock, the princess, the brain, the criminal, and the basket case. But by the end of the film, they'd become closer than any of them could have imagined. The movie, featuring Emilio Estevez, Anthony Michael Hall, Judd Nelson, Molly Ringwald, and Ally Sheedy, is celebrating its anniversary with special screenings at selected theaters across the country tomorrow night, March 26th, and Tuesday night, March 31st. While I have no intention of attending my high school reunion, unsure actually if we are even having one, I have already secured my ticket for this special cinematic event. Well, what can beat that? Well, I found out last week when a copy of the new book, John Hughes, A Life in Film, landed on my desk. Former Hollywood Reporter, film critic, and longtime member of the prestigious Los Angeles Critics Association, Kirk Honeycutt, tells the story of one of the most prolific and successful filmmakers in Hollywood history. So to celebrate The Breakfast Club's anniversary and the genius of John Hughes, we welcome Kirk Honeycutt to the roundtable this morning. Kirk, thank you very much for being with us.
You're more than welcome.
Of course, as we celebrate the 30th anniversary of The Breakfast Club, which I want to talk to you about, let's start with where that film fits into the John Hughes canon, do you think?
You know, I think the film's anomalous in his career. I don't think any film he made ever quite measured up to it in terms of the seriousness of the film. You could make the case that Trains, Planes, and Automobiles does, and a few other films touch lightly upon some serious themes. But this was one where he seemed to be unfolding his heart about what he remembered teenage life and school life to be like.
My God, are we going to be like our parents?
Not me. Ever. It's unavoidable. It just happens.
What happens?
When you grow up, your heart dies.
Who cares?
I care.
And it comes the closest to being a pure film about being young in America, whereas his other films celebrate youth, but they don't kind of dig into it in the same kind of analytical way that he did in that film. So I think that's an unusual film for him, even though it's the one you most readily identify with John Hughes.
It is an interesting film because, as you point out in the book, here is a movie that is often shown as or described as a comedy, but is really deathly serious in some of the topics that it covers, being child abuse and peer pressure and self-loathing and insecurities and parental expectations and ultimately sheer neglect.
That's true. Whenever I show it to a class in my university classes, they've all seen the film and they've seen it more than once. So it still seems to resonate with people in a way that none of his other films do, although they certainly resonate, but don't get me wrong, but this seems to be the one that resonates the most.
As you point out in the filmography that is in the back of your book, as a writer and as an executive producer and producer, he was very prolific. When it comes to the movies that he actually directed, and this surprised me, I think it would surprise most fans, that there were only 8 of them.
That's right. And the last one is so negligible, no one even remembers he did it, Curly Sue. He was embarrassed by it, and he actually never went back to it. And I think he realized that the real joy he had in movie making was in the opening bits, the writing of the script. That's what he was a writer. He was a writer his entire life, going back to his days in advertising. He was a creative director, and then he wrote for the National Lampoon, and he wrote nearly all the screenplays we associate with him. I think there's only one film he produced that he didn't actually write the screenplay, and that was by Chris Columbus. So as a result, he loved writing, and he could be at home with his family doing that. If he had directed, he had to be away from his family and dealing with an atmosphere of crisis management and being on the set early and in the editing rooms late at night. And he got to the point he realized that he wanted to be with his family more and could write more and get away from the directing aspect. So he mostly turned those assignments over to other people. He was quite happy to sort of stay away from that aspect of it and just let the screenplays be developed with him overseeing it, but certainly it's other people in the directing chair.
As you point out, he supposedly wrote Ferris Bueller's Day Off in 4 days and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles in 3 days and The Breakfast Club in 2 days. But as you also point out in the book, these scripts were always in limbo and were always being rewritten. He would see something during the filming, during the day, go home, rewrite it, and represent it the next.
Yes, he did write screenplays fast, but he certainly, when once there was a cast and once there was locations, he made alterations to fit those things. The Breakfast Club is the most extreme example of this, where he essentially let the actors, the five main actors, look over his various drafts and kind of pick out the parts they liked the best, and he kind of rewrote the thing as he was heading into production. In pre-production, he was rewriting the script. And then once in production, he allowed them to ad-lib a great deal. Much of The Breakfast Club is actually ad-lib. Now, they're ad-libbing within the context of a scene that's already set and with characters that are set and with certain dialogue points you have to hit. But they are ad-libbing a great deal, which meant they had to change setups and start shooting all over again to accommodate for those ad-libs. A lot of the scenes towards the end of the film where it gets more serious, where they're talking, they're kind of having less like therapy session among all five of them. That's a lot of ad-libs in there. And he certainly wrote a lot of it, but they wrote a lot of it too on the set. So it was a very collaborative effort. And he encouraged ad-libbing a great deal whenever he was directing.
You tell a great story in the book about when we think of the beginning of that film where the five kids are coming into detention. They go into that library and they sit down, and just where they sit, who they sit with, who they sit on opposite ends of, was something that he left up to the actors to get the feel of their character, of where they would sit within the confines of those roles of the jock and the princess, the brain, the criminal, and the basket case.
Yes, in rehearsal, they were rehearsing, you know, off the set on a part of that school that was not being used by the crew to set up. And I think Judd Nelson, when they came in, he said, wait a minute, I don't want to sit with these people. I want to sit here. He says, well, where do you want to sit, Judd? Well, I want to sit where he's sitting, Anthony Michael Hall. And so, you know, John Hughes looked at Anthony Michael Hall and said, is that okay with you? He said, well, fine, sure. So, and then someone else, well, wait a minute, I don't want to sit with Ali Sheedy. He says, I don't want to sit with them. I want to sit in the back. So pretty soon all the actors kind of dictated how they would sit, and all being faithful to the characters as they understood them. In other words, it wasn't the actors being arrogant. It was simply their feeling that this is the way their character would behave. And he let them kind of direct that scene in one sense, and it's one of the better scenes in the movie. I saw it again a couple nights ago.
All right, people, we're going to try something a little different today. We are going to write an essay of no less than 1,000 words, describing to me who you think you are.
This is a test?
And when I say essay, I mean essay. I do not mean a single word repeated 1,000 times. Is that clear, Mr. Bender?
Crystal.
Good. Maybe you'll learn a little something about yourself. Maybe you'll even decide whether or not you care to return.
Yeah, you know, I can answer that right now, sir. You know, that'd be no for me, because...
Sit down, Johnson.
Thank you, sir.
My office is right across that hall. Any monkey business is ill-advised. Any questions?
Yeah, I got a question. Does Barry Manilow know that you raid his wardrobe?
Give you the answer to that question, Mr. Bender, next Saturday. Don't mess with the bull, young man. You'll get the horns.
It really plays very, very well, and it's quite funny. A lot of that was, as you say, dictated by the way the actors felt their characters would behave.
And that is something that worked and sometimes did not work within the filming of The Breakfast Club. You also relate a story regarding Judd Nelson, who was the oldest of the five. He was 25 years old, and he comes into this as the character Bender, as the criminal of the lot, wearing the trench coat and the whole deal, and he was that character and wanted to be that character both when they were filming and when they were not. And it actually came into causing some issues within the relationship with Molly Ringwald, who he treats with some contempt at the beginning of the film and treated with some contempt during the shooting at the beginning of the film.
I like those earrings, Claire.
Shut up.
Are those real diamonds, Claire?
Shut up.
I bet they are. Did you work for the money?
Shut
for those earrings?
Your mouth.
Or did your daddy buy those?
Shut up!
I bet he bought those for you. I bet those were a Christmas gift, right? You know what I got for Christmas this year? It was a banner f-ing year at the old Bender family. I got a carton of cigarettes. The old man grabbed me and said, hey, smoke up, Johnny. Okay, so go home and cry to your daddy. Don't cry here, okay?
Judd, as I understand it, never really came out of character. Now, I've seen him. He was on the Today Show recently, and someone asked him that same question, and he kind of professes that he wasn't really paying attention and didn't really realize this was happening. But in fact, his manager, who was also his girlfriend at the time, had to fly to Chicago and sit him down and say, look, Judd, if you want to keep your job on this film, you're going to have to start breaking character once the scene's over. You can't go around being Bender all the time and treating Molly Ringwald, not the character she's playing, but Molly Ringwald, as a fellow performer. And he apparently understood that and stopped doing it to some degree, and the film continued. However, it's the fact that John Hughes never worked with Judd Nelson again. There was once he wanted to come in to read for John, and John said, well, he can come in to read, but he's not going to get the job. There was some, as I understand, antipathy between the two, but John Hughes is no longer alive, and I never spoke to him about it when we did talk on the phone many years ago. And as far as Judd Nelson's concerned, he felt that he got along very well with the director. So I only can take it from secondhand that some other people felt that the two of them ultimately didn't get along. Although Ali Sheedy did say to me that the two of them, in terms of their sense of humor, were on the same page. Hmm. They very much found the same things funny, and they kind of had a linkage there. So it looked like it was a kind of a complex relationship between those two. But in all fairness to Judd Nelson, that would be true of John Hughes and many of the people he worked with. He didn't work with too many actors frequently, major actors. The only exception to that would be John Candy. But otherwise, he tended to change producers, he tended to change cameramen, he tended to change actors from show to show. And he also blew up a lot of relationships. He would fall out with a lot of people. So he was a difficult person, too. It wasn't being just Jeff Nelson. It was,
right.
It was John Hughes, too, being a difficult person.
Well, even Molly Ringwald and Anthony Michael Hall both said that they worked with him several times. And then there was a point where John Hughes didn't want to work with them anymore. He felt that they had achieved a level of fame that he was responsible for in many ways, that in some of their descriptions of what had happened and how they achieved that fame, he took some umbrage to and never worked with them again.
That's true. That's true. They did stop working with him. Anthony Michael Hall certainly worked with him on several films back to back to back. And then he wasn't, when he wanted to go off and do other pictures with other people, somehow John took that as a slight. And if directors would work with him for a while, like Chris Columbus, and then want to go off and make other pictures, he took that as a slight. He never could quite see that obviously people would want to do other kinds of roles and other kinds of movies and other kinds of cities other than Chicago. He wanted to set up case in Chicago and work with the same cast and crew, and it doesn't work that way. It was never a logical position for him to take. But somehow he felt this was some kind of betrayal, and he cut people off. And sometimes they got back in the fold, sometimes they didn't. More often than not, they didn't.
Meanwhile, his family was very important, his wife and his two sons, and he wanted to stay in Chicago as much as possible. Even The Breakfast Club was his second major film that he directed, was filmed just a few miles outside of Chicago in an abandoned high school, Maine North High School. It was something that he wanted to be close to home. We even see early on that it shouldn't be too surprising then that here was a guy that became disillusioned with Hollywood and eventually left.
Yes, he lived out here, out here being Los Angeles, where I'm talking, for about 4 years, 4.5 years at most. Joel Silver convinced him to come out. He did for a while. He had his headquarters at Paramount Studios. He had everything, you know, set up very nicely. But he, in the end of the day, wanted to move his family back to Chicago. He just felt more comfortable in the Midwest. He didn't feel comfortable out here. And the town, given how much money he made for them, didn't always treat him well. I mean, it's still amazing to me that Warner Brothers put Home Alone in a turnaround over $1 million difference in the amount of money John wanted to spend and they wanted to spend, which went on to be the most successful comedy in the history of film. It's just amazing that people wouldn't listen to somebody who had his track record. When you have the success of John Hughes, why weren't people listening to him? Why weren't people just saying, yes, John? It's not that you want to be surrounding him with a yes man, but he often was right. He did feel more comfortable at keeping Hollywood at arm's length. He obviously was a Hollywood guy in the sense that they made all his movies and they distributed all his movies and everything was done through Hollywood. He never did it independently. He was not an independent guy. The indie film didn't really exist when he first started making movies. It only came in much later when Sundance became a hip place to go in the late 80s and 90s. So it was not an avenue he ever pursued. He was still a Hollywood person, but he didn't want to be anywhere near Hollywood. He just felt very uncomfortable out here.
The 8 films that he directed, 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, Weird Science, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, She's Having a Baby, Uncle Buck, and as you mentioned, Curly Sue is his final film that he directed. And there were some hits, as you mentioned earlier, and some misses, but The Breakfast Club being a modest hit at the box office, although you point out that the studio hated it.
This is the situation at Universal at the time. The head of the studio had left and formed his own production company, Ned Tannen, and he is the one who sponsored and produced 16 Candles and Breakfast Club. The man who took over for him, Frank Price, there was no love lost between the two of them. That's usual between a former studio head and the guy who takes over for you. And Frank Price never quite got John Hughes. 16 Candles, when it was finally looked at the final cut, he saw that it had some potential. He understood that. But he never understood the film that was known as Detention and later became The Breakfast Club. He never got that. And in fact, they decided to let a marketing company outside of the studio handle the marketing of the film, the promotion, because it just certainly did not fit with the brass of Universal at the time. So, no, they didn't have much faith in it, and they also put it out in a distribution pattern that John Hughes felt was wrong, which is to say it went out very wide instead of what we would now call a platform release, where you release 1 week in a few theaters, and you grow the picture week by week. So it went out, and it did very well, but it didn't do quite what they thought it might do. So, he was not loved at Universal, and so when Ned Tannen decided to move over to Paramount and take over as head of that company, he brought John Hughes with him. He gave him a really good contract over there where he pretty much could do what he wanted to do and didn't have to worry about the Universal brass.
And then there's Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which I guess it goes along with The Breakfast Club as for the films that he directed as the most popular and still celebrated films, and so often quoted, we should mention as well. What was it about the film, do you think, that he was so passionate about and ultimately struck a chord with the audience as well?
Look, he just sat down and wrote it one night. He just came to me and wrote it one night, and he had about 40 pages of it, and he just kept going, and it was a go picture the next week. My understanding is that Matthew Broderick told me the film had a lot of elements that you might think of in terms of The Breakfast Club. Now, there's some darker elements about how maybe sometimes your teenage years might be your peak years, and what do you do after those peak years. And there were some dark elements that were in the original assemblage, the original script, that when Matthew Broderick finally looked at the final cut, he says, oh, he cut it for a comedy, meaning there was not, it was not an out-and-out comedy the way John had originally scripted it. But when John saw what he had in the editing room, he was very good in the editing room, by the way. It was another way of rewriting his script. He cut it for a comedy, and it worked sublimely as a comedy, and he took out anything that might be considered serious. It was just Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And it plays wonderfully, even to this day, as a very lighthearted look at the teen years. There is a serious motif in terms of his friend Cameron, who is got a very difficult relationship at home with his father. You never see his father. It's all in the abstract in that sense. But he's trying to cheer his friend up during this day off. And that's the theme of the movie. It's a very uplifting, upbeat film. It has that great parade sequence down, you know, in downtown Chicago.
You're crazy!
What do you think Ferris is going to do?
It's going to be a fry cook at Venus.
We'll take it up, baby, now.
And as you say, it's very often quoted, and he had a perfect cast. I mean, Matthew Broderick playing much younger than he really was. He was a Broadway veteran playing a kid still. He's a wonderful actor, and probably at that point in time, one of the best actors that John had ever worked with at that point in time. He was just a man who had been a child actor and then had grown out of that, but had gone back for one more day as Ferris Bueller, and it creates this wonderful character that we all know and love.
It seems safe to say, and in reading the book and the terrific interviews that you did with so many people that worked with him for all those years, that as the Breakfast Club gets ready to celebrate the 30th anniversary with these screenings, that this would be something that he would, if he were with us, would have no part of.
I wonder how he would be if he were alive today. He'd only be in his mid-60s. I'm not so sure he wouldn't go to one of the South by South screenings, or maybe one of these screenings on the 26th or the 30th. I'm not so sure. He might be interested in how people are responding to it. I think he would enjoy the fact that, as I said with my own class, I discovered two more generations of kids have watched these films and still respond to them. I can't help but think he would love that. Whether he would show up or not is another question, because he became a little reclusive, but the fact that, you know, his grandchildren would now be looking at these films, and I think he would really dig that. I think he would really enjoy that. Maybe he wouldn't come out for it, but I think he'd really love it.
The book is terrific and an awful lot of fun to read. It is John Hughes, A Life in Film. Kirk Honeycutt is the author. It is published by Race Point. Kirk Honeycutt, thank you very much for being with us and sharing your knowledge. I appreciate it.
You're more than welcome.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, John Hughes, A Life in Film by Kirk Honeycutt, published by Race Point. You can also find out more information about the Breakfast Club anniversary screening March 26th and the 31st by going to fathomevents.com, fathomevents.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Dear Mr. Vernon, we accept the fact that we had to sacrifice a whole Saturday in detention for whatever it was we did wrong. But we think you're crazy to make us write an essay telling you who we think we are. And you see us as you want to see us. In the simplest terms, with the most convenient definitions. But what we found out is that each one of us is a brain. And an athlete.
And a basket case. A princess.
And a criminal. Does that answer your question? Sincerely yours. The Breakfast Club. Don't.